troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody, Cameron and Kevin, or maybe I should say Cameron and Vern, here again with you.
If only I could.
very excited to be back. I got some very interesting stories to talk about. So with that ridiculous banter out of the way, let's just jump into it, Kevin. So first up, tiny lab-grown livers have moved us closer to producing organs on demand, but how does the technology actually work, and then what are some of the implications of such a massive development like this? Next up, the pandemic has caused delays in testing of gene therapies for rare diseases, and so we're going to talk about some of the trade-offs involved in battling a pandemic like the one that we're currently in. Regenerative agriculture has been promised as a major solution to climate change. And so we're going to get into some of the evidence because, as it turns out, carbon farming, as it's also called, might not be the solution that we've been told it is. And then finally, the EPA is allowing farmers to continue using banned dicamba weed killers until July 31st. And this has sparked a huge controversy, and there's a major lawsuit battle going on right now. So we're going to dive into that as well. But Kevin, first up, let's talk about these lab-grown livers. This is some pretty fascinating stuff.
Yeah, and it's really a big deal. And this story comes from SciTech Daily from June 17th of this year. And the basic idea is that there are 6,500 liver transplants performed every single year in the U.S. alone. And it's increasing numbers because there's now new therapies for hepatitis C that allow people to live longer, but eventually sometimes have liver indications. More people with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease from metabolic syndrome. Right now, it looks like there's larger waiting lists and bigger than ever. And right now, just in the U.S., there's 17,000 people on the waiting list for 6,500 liver transplants. So what this means is that you're on the waiting list for over 300 days on average, and 20% of people die while on the list. So there is definitely a need for livers. And there's a few places, a few ways this has been done. The idea of xenotransplantation, so X-E-N-O, so xenotransplantation, meaning growing them in heterologous organisms, so growing it in a pig or whatever. There's been a lot of discussion of this over time that you could use genetic engineering to fix some of the incompatibilities and some of the things that, you know, rejection and those kinds of things. It's worked to some degree with tests of pig livers in non-human primates, so which I always like that term because we're primates, and relatively short survival time. So really what we need is a better solution. And another way they've been doing this is kind of cool. It's called bio-enhanced transplantation or something along that line, where you actually get an infusion of pig liver cells, and they find a home in your liver. They kind of zero in to where they're supposed to be. They integrate and pick up liver function. So kind of a cool set of ideas, but this other thing is really something new.
So in this case, Kevin, they are taking human skin cells and then turning them into pluripotent stem cells and then turning them into liver cells. Can you, without getting too technical, describe that process? Most people probably didn't even know that was possible.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty cool trick. So the big problem with working with animal cells is that they differentiate. They go from a preliminary stem cell type, which can take on many different final fates, right? We all start from one cell, and those cells turn into ball of cells that then start to differentiate into different roles and different jobs. And typically with human or animal cells, that's a one-way trip. Once you're a brain cell, you're a brain cell. You're a liver cell, you're a liver cell. Plants, it's very different. You know, we all took a cutting and made new roots on it, right? So one of the cool things about plants. But the idea here is that you can now take skin cells and make them what is known as pluripotent. Give them the ability to differentiate into a variety of different cell types if you give them the correct information. And so in this case, researchers have been able to take those pluripotent cells and be able to, so dedifferentiated skin cells brought back from their terminal fate to a pluripotent form, which now means they can take on many different forms. And with the right chemical treatments, hormones and growth regulators, they're able to differentiate them into liver cells.
So this is almost some Brave New World kind of stuff that we're talking about. At least the concept of it is, I imagine this is still a long way from hitting the market in terms of, oh, you know, my liver's bad, I'm just going to buy a new one. Where are we at in that evolution of developing a technology like this? This seems like it's still in its infancy, if I'm reading this correctly.
Yeah, the world's worst, most expensive vending machine. New liver. I guess the idea is that, and this has been done for some time. I mean, even back when I was in grad school, they were making muscle cells in a dish from pluripotent cells because we know the signals that cause those differentiation events. The big challenge now is, how do you get the cells to behave as a tissue or an organ? Because you have all these individual cells. And the way they've been able to do this with other types of organs, like hearts and things, is to scaffoldize them. So you use acellular structures or acellular matrices to provide some sort of structure that cells can gravitate to and now have the ability to function in mass in that form. Now, this is a long way from being done, but they've made these little livers that in rats that can, from stem cells in rats that now can behave like liver cells. They do all of the filtration they're supposed to do. They produce the compounds they're supposed to produce. They produce some of the enzymes they're supposed to produce. So what this cells is that what this says is you're able to create this small pseudo liver that behaves like a liver from these pluripotent stem cells. And it's a big breakthrough, a long way from being used therapeutically, but it's something on the horizon.
So final question just before we move on. And again, we know this is pretty far away still, but are there any ethical implications of being able to grow human organs in the lab? You know, I mean, like, for example, when it comes to like weight loss drugs or surgery to literally prevent you from eating too much. You know what I mean? I've heard people say those aren't good because they don't fix the problem. They don't fix the issues with your diet or whatever your bad habits are. Does this present that kind of a challenge as well? You know, I mean, there's people who are legitimately sick and will benefit, but for say people who are alcoholics or they just eat poorly and so their livers don't function correctly, you know, are there any implications that we need to consider about something like this in your judgment?
Well, I'd like to think of this as just being an extension of the normal transplant protocols, where they do have certain ethical standards as to who goes first on that waiting list. What this might be able to do is populate that waiting list with more livers so that more people can live. And the ethical considerations around that, they can sort out. But at least it takes away from that waiting list. Really, the easiest way to do this would get everybody to just sign up to donate their organs after they're dead. Hey, you're not using it anymore, pass it on. And that would be another solution that would make us not need rat livers. But hey, who, you know, what do I know, right?
So maybe it's something to tackle in the future, but I guess we'll find out. But we've been talking a lot, even on this podcast, about how there are certain trade-offs when you're dealing with a pandemic, Kevin, and people have complained about, you know, the social health implications of being locked inside or people not getting healthcare that's related to non-COVID issues. But I haven't heard anything about this next story, which is gene therapy trials being halted because of this. So talk about this. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this comes from Larry Luxner of AHUS News, and really focuses on discussions from the World Orphan Drug Congress. And what this basically says is that a lot of the low priority drugs, especially gene therapies that are exceedingly expensive, a lot of these drugs that are in trials and things that are happening right now are being delayed because of COVID-19. And a lot of these are for rare diseases, smaller studies. They're the first ones to get cut. And this is a major problem because there are people enrolled in these trials that all of a sudden, because of the COVID situation, find their trial is delayed or halted or otherwise cut loose. You know, they're cut loose from the therapy that may have had some benefit. Most of all, we don't obtain the information the clinical trial was set out to produce. So that's the problem in a nutshell.
So first off, was this necessary to halt these, or was it more of a precautionary approach? Just because the pandemic's happening, we can't really know how this is going to affect the research or affect the people involved. So we just have to put it on hold?
Well, it's all the above. The article cites that you now have different access to hospitals. You know, so right there changes the dynamic of someone who's coming in on a voluntary basis to be able to access the facility. People aren't enrolling for the studies because who wants to go sit in a hospital with people who have this potentially transmissible virus? The other big problem is that you may have clinical trials that are mostly done, but you have some data that are missing, and now it's incomplete. So these are the weird, ragged edges of the problem that really are hindering progress in clinical trials.
There's two things they mentioned in the article towards the end, and I want you to comment on both of them. And the first one is that, you know, not a shortage, but slowing research like this, it emphasizes the importance of more generally getting medicine to people quicker and speeding up that approval process as much as is safely possible. So what are your thoughts on that? And then we'll move on to this final point.
Well, yeah, the article talks about the importance of innovation and then getting that innovation come to market fast. And what they said is that if we learn something from COVID-19 is that we can go a lot faster. And when you mobilize the resources and you get laboratories all over the world focused on a common problem, whether it's vaccines, therapeutics, protocols for managing the disease, you're going to make progress faster. In the news today was the news from Portugal, where steroid therapies to battle lung inflammation have led to less mortality in treatment of COVID patients. So we only learn these things because everybody's hammering away full speed. And that's a huge advantage to having everybody focused on one problem. It also shows with the issue of vaccines, how do we get it done fast? Not just from a safety and efficacy standpoint, but from an approval and then from a manufacturing and dissemination standpoint. So it shows us that we can do better.
And then the final issue, of course, is the cost. I mean, some of these gene therapies per dose, they cost over $1 million. And so for most people, I would imagine that puts them completely out of touch. You know, and so that's tragic. And so maybe something like this recession that's caused by the pandemic is going to bring attention to this issue.
Yeah. Now there's the worst vending machine ever. Dose of meds. Just slide your credit card on that one.
Oh boy.
No, they point out Glybera, which is, they didn't say what it exactly treats, but I believe that one is a lipase deficiency for pancreatitis. It's a gene therapy that was used for a while. It was at $1.2 million a dose, and they only gave out 31 doses before it was recalled. So not so good. But the gene therapy called Zolgensma, it's one that treats children with a spinal disorder, a spinal atrophy, and spinal muscular atrophy. And that retails for $2.125 million for a single treatment and 45 cents.
Can't forget treatment. The 45 cents.
but the point is a good one is that, you know, now that we're in an economic shakeup and the snow globe has been shaken and we're watching things settle, it's very likely that we're heading hard into inflationary times with all the new money printed. It may be a time to reassess how needed vital drugs that are life-saving for some people are marketed and sold, and how that approval process works to make it profitable and reasonable for companies to participate in the development of these resources without the extraneous price tag, and maybe a good time to rethink everything.
Kevin Folta dropping some economics on everybody. I'm impressed. Wow.
well, you know, it's the world's just a big vending machine, you know.
We have to start using that when it's totally inappropriate and it doesn't work as an analogy. I think that'd be hilarious.
I can do that.
So speaking of expensive vending machines, regenerative agriculture, Kevin, I mean, people are promising that these practices are going to really put a dent in climate change. So tell us what that is, first of all, and then why people think it's so promising.
Yeah. So for a long time, I've talked about the carbon economy. And people will argue up and down about climate change and the burning of fossil fuels. But I like to put it this way. We are literally mining carbon out of the earth and putting it into the atmosphere. It's a very simple thing. And the idea here with regenerative agriculture is that plants turn carbon dioxide into stuff. They turn it into structures, all the carbon that gets fixed inside the cell that's used for energy and for structural elements within cells. And one of the places this happens is you make roots. And so you're putting, in essence, carbon back into the earth, which is kind of completing the cycle, because the oil and fossil fuel we're burning was at one time plant matter from 250 million years ago that was present in the earth. So it's an interesting analogy. The idea of regenerative agriculture is, can you put carbon back into the earth, either by means of rooting or by plants that grow very quickly, then integrating them back into the soil? And when you couple this with ideas like, a low-till farming, drilling seeds in rather than tilling seeds in, it allows carbon to stay in the earth. And that's really the idea behind the regenerative agriculture.
So one of the biggest criticisms I've seen, and you, of course, have way more expertise on this, but the biggest criticism I've seen is that in order to implement these practices on a massive scale, in order to feed people, you'd have to cut down more forests, eliminate more grassland and plant more crops. And so in the process of doing that, you're releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and that could very well offset whatever benefit you're gaining from storing carbon in the soil. So talk about that. And then if you have any other thoughts on why this might not be as effective as people think, then share it with our audience.
Well, that's exactly the problem that they've run into. There are companies that are actually offering farmers to pay farmers for carbon farming. So for every metric ton of carbon that they store, they get $15. And big companies are starting to line up to do this. So when Kellogg's, General Foods, all the big food companies are now lining up and saying, hey, we contract acres and acres of farming, we'll take the $15 an acre. So it's one of these deals where you start to see a little gamesmanship in the system. And Indigo is the company that's doing this. They want farmers to buy their seed coatings because they have these bacterial mixes that apparently help the plants store more carbon and sequester more carbon, photosynthesize more in conjunction with the microbes in the soil. And the basic idea is that you're able to put more carbon in the soil, but then the problem is that it incentivizes farmers to say, okay, if I'm getting an extra $15 for every metric ton I shove in the ground, if I can cut down those forests over there, that's nothing more than more space that I can use to harvest carbon. And at the same time, you are releasing carbon. And so there's been a lot of criticism about this because it's very unclear how you measure how much carbon has been sequestered. And that depends on soil, climate, water, plant type, you know, everything. So the rules are really loose and really kind of crazy. And the article I neglected to mention was by James Temple at MIT Technology Review. talks about the issue of you have the big companies that are offering the offsets, making the rules for how they're going to apply the offsets. And it just opens up everything to a lot of at least skepticism as to whether it will be a legitimate way to curb emissions. And the basic idea is, why give credit for harvesting carbon over here when 100 miles away or on the other side of the earth, the same company is quadrupling their carbon emissions? And it's kind of like the analogy is the no peeing in the swimming pool argument, right? The no peeing zone. You know, it does, you lose the benefit. And so that is the main criticism.
I years ago now, I interviewed a climatologist named Scott Denning, who's an interesting guy because he actually goes to climate change skeptic conferences and he argues with them. I always thought that was an interesting approach to science communication. But during our interview, one thing he said is that, and he's, you know, making fun of Game of Thrones here, but he says, all plants must die. And I think that really sums up the issue we're talking about, is that you can store it in the ground, but if you're going to cut down more stuff, then you're just not solving the problem. So maybe that's a useful way to look at it. And then just a final thought, and then comment on this before we move on, Kevin, but it just seems like intensive agriculture is the best way to achieve the goal of this. What do you think of that?
Well, it's about smart intensification. We can't take more forest. We can't expand the land. We've got more people and more need coming. So we need more production per acre. And that's going to come from genetics. It's going to come from improvement in genetics, improvement in exploiting and understanding the symbionts, these organisms that are living with the plants in the soil, improvement of soils, better fertilizers, encapsulated fertilizers, all kinds of new technologies with sensors and drones and you name it. It's going to take everything to make it happen.
So more technology, less land. That's what we need.
Yeah, more technology. And we're in a time when many are encouraging going backwards with technology, less technology. And I don't know that that's necessarily ever got us out of any problem.
Yeah. not that I can think of for sure, but maybe we'll talk about some example in the future. But let's talk about this issue with dicamba. This is super controversial, at least in the food and farming world. So give people just a brief synopsis of what the problem is, and then let's talk about this fight going on between the EPA and the Ninth Circuit Court.
Yeah, so this article comes from Emily Unglesby of Progressive Farmer this week, and it deals with the issue of dicamba. Now, dicamba is an old herbicide, going back to, I think, 1967, 1965, and it works very well. It is very indiscriminate. It works great on broadleaf plants. It works well on everything. It is, we can go into the details, but the bottom line is that it's an old legacy herbicide, and its chemistry is very well understood. Over the last couple of years, it's been started to be used in genetically engineered plants because glyphosate was overused. You find glyphosate-resistant weeds. And so those farmers now are turning either away from glyphosate use or they have to team it with something else. So they add, the companies that make the seeds have added dicamba resistance to that trait package. So it's mostly in cotton and soybeans. So you spray this dicamba and glyphosate mixture, it kills all the weeds and leaves the crop. The problem is dicamba has volatilization under the conditions in which it's sprayed. Occasionally, you can have conditions where dicamba forms a cloud of mist, or basically a molecular cloud, and it's not just drift, like blowing into the next field. It's picked up by temperature inversions, which is an atmospheric phenomenon. It's picked up as a vapor, moves up into the atmosphere, moves down a few miles, and then drops back down. So you have the herbicide now leaving where it was intended to work, dropping into peach orchards and tomato fields and vineyards, and causing unprecedented damage throughout different areas of the United States. So the problem is farmers are saying we're doing it right. Companies are saying, well, farmers, you're not doing it right. And farmers are saying, well, you guys gave us the wrong formulation. So there's that argument. And then you have university scientists and some of the best extension people in the country, I should add, stepping into this and saying, hey, listen, we think you're both have issues here, and mostly the companies, for putting something out that was not ready for prime time. And so that's it in a nutshell. And the basic situation is that this was approved in 2016, and now for a few years you've had tremendous losses from dicamba damage in adjacent fields to where it was used.
And so what we're facing now is you have a handful of activist groups and some farm groups, I believe, as well, who sued the EPA for approving this, because they alleged, and there seems to be some evidence for this, that the companies and then perhaps the EPA minimized the possible effects, these drifting or volatilization effects that you're talking about. And so they convinced a federal court to agree with them. And so the court said, hey, you got to pull these herbicides off the market. And I believe there's three in question right now. And then all the farmers that already bought the herbicides and they bought the resistant seeds are saying, well, now what do we do? Because we got to grow our crops. And so the EPA came back and said, okay, well, you have until July 31st of 2020 to utilize this technology, and then it's officially off the market. And then the court came back because the people who filed the lawsuit said that's not good enough. And so now you have this back and forth going on. And, you know, as I said, Kevin, it seems like both sides have some legitimate complaint, you know? So, I mean, what's going to, I don't know if you can predict it, but what are your thoughts on that? Are we dealing with a situation where you have people on both sides that have, you know, legitimate frustration?
Yeah, well, let me throw in one more layer of nuance here, is that farmers are allowed to use it if they already have it, but only until July 31st. They can't even buy new now. And so if you planted the seeds and you didn't buy the weed control, now you're out of luck. You got to come up with some other strategy, which I don't know what that would even be, other than manual cultivation. I don't know what else you'd do. So the problem that we're up against right now is the timing of this. The fact that the activist organizations, you're right. I mean, I think they have a legitimate gripe here, as do the companies, but the EPA. Maybe they shouldn't have approved it for this year with all the problems that it's had. The problem is they're sticking it to the farmers in the middle of the season. At least let them finish the season, then let's ban it or whatever. And then we can reopen that discussion with more nuance. Because I believe, you know, some of the extension people, and I'm not going to name names because they've gone through enough hell, they're really good. And they tend to concur that this has moved a little too fast despite the problems that are there and very apparent.
I read the court decision, the initial one, when they revoked the registration, as it's called, for these herbicides. And they acknowledged that this would be tough on farmers. They said, you know, these people followed the rules, they did everything they were supposed to, but more or less sucks to be you because these have to come off the market. So they acknowledged that problem is real, but then it's almost like they didn't care enough to go, you know, let us think through how we should, you know, enact this order. So I get a sense that there's like a detachment, you know, we talked about it last time about you have, you know, different cultures, really, like on the coasts of the country, you have people that think a certain way. And then you have the Midwest where you have farmers, where all the food is grown. And so I sense that there's a bit of a detachment related to that issue. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I agree 1,000%. You know, this takes, it stops the farmer from doing what they can do. And they've already invested in the field. This will bankrupt people. I mean, this will have tremendous ramifications. They invested in, you know, how many tens of thousands of dollars in seed to plant, and now can't treat it appropriately to where they can profitably harvest it. And, you know, that's a bad scene. And, you know, and the thing is, you got folks who are with, you know, the plaintiffs in this are Center for Food Safety, Pesticide Action Network, National Family Farm Coalition, you know, they're, you know, which sounds all good until you read some of their agenda. The bottom line is that these are folks who want to end modern agriculture. And they're doing this in this kind of erosion way where, okay, we're going to now take this set of soybean and cotton farmers and really screw them. Let's force them out of business. I can't help but think that that's the agenda of these groups, especially folks like Andrew Kimbrell and some of the folks involved here. And unfortunately, the companies, by not doing their homework, have provided them a perfect scenario to be able to stick it to the farmer. And so it's a lose-lose all the way around.
Yeah, very good point. I'm glad we ended on that, because you know they are taking advantage of what is a legitimate issue to push an agenda that isn't necessarily related to helping the farmers whose crops have been damaged by dicamba. So very, very good point to think about. But the situation's in flux. By the time this podcast airs, something may have changed. And so I encourage you guys to monitor it if you're interested in it. And then, of course, if something big happens, then we're going to cover it as well. But we're just going to have to see what happens. And on that note, Kevin, what's going on with your other podcast?
Well, the Talking Biotech podcast last week, 2 weekends ago, was Rob Fraley, who is the former chief technology officer of Monsanto. A really nice talk about where plant genetic engineering started and where the future of farming is going. This week is the last Saturday is Ilaria Capua. Dr. Ilaria Capua is, she was a member of Italian Parliament. She's a professor. She's a virologist. She's a brilliant mind who talks about the current state of COVID-19. And just to give you a tip of the hat, she says, viruses do not cause pandemics. People cause pandemics. And it was some of the most enlightening discussion, because she reminds us that the virus is doing what the virus does. It's what we do in response to it that decides whether or not people will be injured or not. And that's a really interesting way to think about it.
Absolutely. Well, go check it out, talkingbiotechpodcast.com. And you can get our podcast on iTunes and Spotify. We are at geneticliteracyproject.org. And at Kevin Folta on Twitter, at CamJEnglish. And we will see you guys next week. Thank you so much.